Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Okay, if you know my next guest, you're going to be thrilled now. And if you don't, I really think you're going to enjoy him. So he's a brilliant and hugely successful comedian. He's also an actor, a writer, a musician, a poet, a composer, a songwriter. And on top of all that, he's a doctor three times over. So he's mainly here today to give us some life advice. Tim Minchin, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brendan. Yeah, I'm a highly regarded doctor of absolutely nothing.
Should I call you Dr. Tim or do you insist on that?
If you wouldn't mind addressing me as Dr. Tim, that would be ideal.
Okay, could I go Dr. Cubed Tim?
Yeah, that'd be
for short. Yeah,
be scientific about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Tim, yeah, I'd be like, your tentacles are everywhere. A lot of us got to know you through your musical comedy, and then there's this whole other generation. Now, my kids and that know you as the creator of Matilda the musical. Explain the doctor business.
If you're lucky like I am, and you find a profile in the arts, you might get approached by a university or two, and they'll offer you an honorary doctor. I'm an honorary doctor of letters three times over. I think it's the same sort of honorary degree. And look, I can obviously take the mick out of them because they're promotional exercises by universities, but also they're an honor. It's a genuine honor. They're honorary. And I've accepted three of these things, two from universities I attended in West Australia and one from Mount View Academy, which is a theatre school in North London. And the deal is when you get one of these things is you turn up to a ceremony and they give you a ridiculous hat and a cape. But your job is to give a speech, a graduation speech. And it's always an opportunity for me to do what I do best, which is pontificate. And but it's a chance to talk to younger people. And obviously what people are interested in from someone like me is to talk about creativity and how to go about being an artist and stuff. And so I've done three of those speeches, and then they've been collected into a book, and I've written some essays just to tie them all together. And that's what it is.
Okay, so the nine life lessons speech, which has become, to overuse the word, iconic at this stage, you gave that at your old university, University of Western Australia, in 2013. How many people have watched that now, roughly, on the internet?
Well, it's hard to track. I mean, the weird thing is it's got some millions of views on the original video, but there's this, I think the website's called Goldcast. I don't know if it still exists. I'm not sort of online very much these days, but it's like American-based sort of self-helpy thing. They post speeches and inspirational quotes and memes about how life is like being a cat hanging on a windowsill or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they took the speech and cut out some of the sort of more obtuse stuff and put inspirational images over it and posted it. And I think that video has 180 million views or something.
Oh, my God. You're probably bigger than Deepak Chopra in this space now.
I should be. I'm definitely more magic than Deepak.
Did you realise writing this, that this could actually be your most impactful piece of work you've ever done in your life? All the fantastic
Exactly, right? Of all the things I've spent months on, it's this thing I spent a day on where I just sort of say some thoughts I've had. It probably did change my life a bit, as in I was in my late 30s when I wrote that speech, and realizing that basically me expressing what is a general humanist worldview about, you know, the world, like I'm not a religious person, I'm not Deepak Chopra, I'm not spiritual. My view of the world is a sort of humanist worldview that you have to create meaning, and it's about treating each other. You know, it's not new ideas, but realizing that people liked the way I expressed that stuff as much as they did, kind of probably made me the pompous idiot that I am today. it just made me feel good about expressing ideas more because they landed in a way that seemed to really resonate with people. So it's been really nice.
Yeah, yeah. And they say nothing good comes from the internet, and there you go. It turns you into the pompous.
Oh my God! Well, yeah. If I had a magic wand and I could delete the internet, I probably would. But it's certainly the only reason I've got a career is that people have been able to pass my stuff around.
So listen, I know like it was a long time ago and everything, but there is good stuff in it. Do you mind if we talk through a little bit of it just to, you know, to give the listeners the benefit of it? So the name of the book and the kind of headline on the speech, it's okay not to have a dream. And obviously that seems a bit counterintuitive because we're always told we should have a dream. Like, I think a lot of us feel quite under pressure these days to have a dream and to, quotes, follow your dream.
Yeah, so I think a lot of what I've done in my career is sort of trying to offset some of the ideas that I think are nice but not necessarily useful. So obviously, if you have something you're passionate about from a very young age and you think one day I'm going to have my name in lights or one of these, you know, which is a stupid dream, really. You shouldn't worry about whether your name's going to be lit up. You should worry about the thing you're passionate about. But that's all fine. And I say that in the speech. If you've got a big dream, then good-o. But the idea that everyone has a vocation, that it's almost like a mythology that somewhere in your soul is the true you who is going to be the world leader at something. And these days, of course, it's all connected to the myth of fame being good and of wealth being the thing that will bring you happiness. And it's all a bit broken. And the internet's part of this because everything becomes memeified, you know. And so I really wanted to just say to especially graduates and young people who might be interested in the arts that having a long-term dream is, I never did. I just really loved playing the piano, so I worked really hard at that. And then one day someone noticed I could write songs and they asked me to write some songs for a youth theatre production. And when that happened, I got $500 to write 10 songs or whatever, and I just absolutely threw myself into that. Not because I thought, if I do this well, that'll be a step on the ladder to fame and fortune. Simply because that was what was in front of me and I just threw myself into that. And then something else came along and I was in a disco band and I threw myself into that. And so that part of the speech is really, I talk about dedication on short-term goals. I talk about being micro-ambitious. So don't be ambitious for the long game. Just be ambitious to do a really good job at what you're doing and the long game will look after itself. And I think that advice stands up. I think it's helpful for
people.
I think
that's still sound advice, yeah. And then you kind of allude to another life lesson that you gave in the speech there when you talk about getting money to write some songs for a production, then the disco band and everything. You point out that really everything is luck. I think people don't realise it enough. You know, life really is largely a product of good luck and bad luck, isn't it?
It is. And someone said recently to me something that really landed, which is people who don't realise how much luck is the main thing, the main reason for their success, they tend to be people who have had very bad luck. Like, even if you've lived a relatively lucky life, if you've ever experienced really bad luck, then when it's bad luck, we all know it's luck. But when we succeed, we think it's us, you know. It's like, we're very like, well, you know, and that's the nature of, you know, very right-wing people or whatever. And I don't believe in right and left wings. It's sort of a false dichotomy. But, you know, people like, well, I did it. You know, why should I pay a lot of tax and help that lazy person? I pull myself up by my bootlaces or whatever. And you're like, yes, that's absolutely true. But you got born with a brain that had the capacity to do that. And, you know, So this idea of luck, I say it's all luck, and people go, but you've worked hard. And I'm like, yeah, but I didn't teach myself to work hard. This is something I inherited from my genes and my parents. So it's luck all the way down. You know, the fact that you're born in that place with those skills, and even if you had a really, I say it in the speech, even if you had a hard childhood, if the way your brain reacted to your childhood is to become incredibly ambitious and diligent, then that's luck. But this is Brendan, you and I could talk about this for 3 hours and we still wouldn't scrape the surface of what I mean by luck. But I love hearing you say that you feel that in yourself as well, because I think it's a hard chat to have because people mean different things when they talk about luck.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's some people who love to say, well, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I get. In other words,
which is true. That is also true. Yeah, there's truth in all this stuff, you know. But this is actually a discussion about free will and determinism, and I'm not sure we're going to get through it.
Listen, if you're saying that I'm not able for a discussion on free will and determinism and that our listeners aren't able for it, you're sorely mistaken. We take them to some very obscure places, I'll have you know.
We just need an hour and a half.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's rock on. So, because, and these are all kind of interlinked, really, because that brings us neatly on to the next one, which is be hard on your opinions. And I know this is a big theme of yours, and it's a big issue in the world, isn't it? That and this is around everybody being stuck into these very definite black and white opinions and dug into trenches and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think they, you know, I call social media, our phones are extremification machines. And it's one thing to, like me, I can't, you know, I studied a bit of logical philosophy, and certainly in terms of my reading and stuff in my 20s, critical thinking, it sounds boring, but I love critical thinking, and I think we need lots more of it and needs to be taught in middle school and all this stuff. But I can bang on about it. I still find it unbelievably hard to apply, especially in a social media world. You're just trying to check your biases, right? I talk about in the book about humility, right? Not humility like, oh, I'm really modest, but humility as in understanding the ways in which you go wrong. And I talk about neurological, psychological, epistemic, and cultural humility, understanding that everything you think is susceptible to biases of the brain and the psyche and our culture and our gender and, you know, everything. And I know all this stuff, and yet it's so hard to have an opinion and not just go seeking affirming information. It's so hard to believe something and set about to try and disprove your belief in order to test its veracity. It is a life's project for me to be someone who can change their mind, and yet still I know I'm in my bubble and I know I mostly seek confirming information. And so, look, I'm passionate about it, but I'm not a guru of it. I think the value system should be absolutely spread through education, and we should teach everyone that their job is to listen to counter arguments all the time.
Yeah.
And we just don't do it, because all social media does is throw up our own opinions mirrored back at us through a righteous lens of, you know, perfection. You know, like, I'm amazing, everything I think is true, and I feel it really passionately, and now I'm going to shout at everyone I disagree with, and that's going to make the world a better place, you know.
I'm thinking, though, you're back living in Australia now, and look, massive stereotype here, but my view would be that Australia isn't exactly a bubble of your kind of thinking people, is it? Are you confronted with like, Australia hasn't exactly been taken over by the wokerati or anything, has it? Are you confronted by a lot of people who'd be very different to you living there?
Yes, there's a lot of people with very different views in Australia. Australia is a hugely multicultural place. People come from very different backgrounds. It's probably it'd be a more secular place than a lot of places in the world. It'd probably be more secular than Ireland, because we have different histories. I don't think it's very easy to say anything very interesting about whole countries. I would say the distribution of people who hold various beliefs would be not dissimilar from Europe. But it seems we inherit a lot of America's anxiety. The whole world does, right? We're bathed in US culture. And I've been very anxious watching how both the far left, which is not really the far left anymore, or it's not really left anymore, it's something else, and the far right, which is not really conservative anymore, it's something else. It's really just bonkers kind of bubble stuff. I've been worried that we're in Australia are just mimicking the US, that the things we obsess over, the social justice issues we obsess over, are really inherited from the US, and they're not our own, and same with the far right conspiracy theories and stuff. But here we are with a centre-left working-class prime minister, and England now has that as well. And I don't know how much one should feel optimistic about that. Obviously, if Kamala gets in the US, we have another centre-left, you know, person from a not particularly posh heritage. And should we feel optimistic, or is that just...
We've got our headline right there. Minchin says we're coming back from the brink.
Well, I try to feel like that. It's hard not to feel despairing, isn't it? But it's so hard to know, right? Like, I feel all this anxiety, but maybe that's just what my internet bubble's feeding me. You know, actually, since I got off social media 8 months ago, I have more capacity to be optimistic. I hope that's not because I've got blinkers on. I hope it's because I'm less poisoned. But I don't know which one it is.
No, I think it's because you're less poisoned. It's interesting you say about America exporting their neuroses and culture wars and everything else, because the second speech in the book, which is in 2015, right? So this is when Matilda the musical has been a huge success and you got an honorary doctorate from the Mount View Academy in London. So cue another speech. But in terms of where you were at that point in your life, you were living in Hollywood, but weirdly, you'd gone there to take a step back from fame. Explain that phase of life to me.
Well, yeah, I had reached, you know, arenas and I had been touring, you know, 8,000 seaters with a 55-piece symphony orchestra. And I had taken musical comedy to what I felt was Albert Hall with a symphony orchestra. Like I couldn't go further with it. And also I've always been ambitious to not be able to be put in a pigeonhole. And I knew that if I just kept doing comedy, I'd end up on a panel show or whatever. And that it's a great honour. And I'm so stoked that people came to my comedy shows. But in the back of my head, I always wanted to be an actor and I'm a singer-songwriter. And I didn't want to be writing flippant songs my whole life. So I kind of stopped. And one of the things I did, apart from doing Californication and Jesus Christ Superstar and going back to Australia and doing a play and laying the foundations for the career I've ended up having where I've got to do telly and stuff, I also took a job composing for an Australian outback musical that was going to be an animated film at DreamWorks. And then after about a year or so of working on that, I was so, as you can imagine, so vocal with my ideas that they said, well, if you're so passionate about this, why don't you direct it? And so I moved my family to LA to direct an animated film. And yes, part of that was because I had got to the point where, you know, walking through our local village in London, it would draw a bit of attention. Not like, it's absolutely fine, but I had that experience of going, oh, that feels good, because my ego likes hearing people go, that's Tim Minchin. But that doesn't feel like a good thing for my kids. And actually, I think in the long term, that's not very good for your psyche. So yes, I went to Hollywood to get less famous.
Yeah. And you can see in the speech, it's fair to say that you were getting disillusioned with Hollywood by then.
It's not that. I my speeches are a bit about trying to undo some of the less useful myths. And the myth that fame's a really good thing to aim for is incredibly pervasive these days. Like if you ask 1,000 kids, what do you want to do when you grow up? Apparently in America, half of them will say, I want to be famous. You know, it's like such a weird thing to want, but I wanted it. I wanted recognition. Of course, I'm an artist with a fragile ego. I wanted everyone to clap, but I recognized that in myself. And then I got to meet some really, really famous people, and a lot of them have good lives, but I don't think it's very good for you to not be able to go to the shop and buy a pint of milk. You know,
Are you saying they turn into monsters?
No, some of them do, but I just don't think it's a very happy life. Like, what are your favourite things in life, Brendan? I mean, are you happiest when you're locked in your house and not able to go out? Like, we all experience that, right, in 2020. Like, really famous people, basically, if they want to go to the shop, they have to, like, put on a hat or even if they're not so famous that they're being followed by paparazzi, it's still, even I got to the point where I was like, oh, I don't think I will go into town because, you know, I'll get asked for a photo and I'm not really in the mood. I'm not feeling very good and my skin's a bit spotty, so I think I won't go out today. And as soon as I glimpsed that, I was like, man, I got to tell the kids that this is not the vibe, you know? Like, yeah. So it was a bit mean doing a speech to a bunch of actor graduates with stars in their eyes saying, you don't want what you think you want. But that's what I did.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's big-hearted enough to have not been too scolding.
Yeah. And it was fun and everything. But you paint a picture of an actor's career and I think kind of gradually losing authenticity and the reasons you might have got into it in the first place. Would that be the gist of it? Yeah.
Exactly that. And just the de-romanticism. Look, I think if there's one thing I've done throughout my career in my comedy and even in Groundhog Day and in my speeches is that I have an inclination to unpack or slightly dissect old notions of romance and what life's about and then try and rebuild them through my own humanist lens. So the myths of love being about soulmates and the myths of acting being about, you know, creativity and stuff. I have a tendency to deconstruct this stuff and go, no, love is just as beautiful as that, but it's more real than that. It's harder than that. I have a song in my album called Apart Together that's about the fact that having a lifelong relationship, like I've been with my wife since we were teenagers, and that really it's about witnessing one another's decay. And it's sort of funny, but I find it really beautiful that that's what love is, that love is witnessing one another's decay. And similarly, the idea that Hollywood superstardom is like something to be aimed for, I can't help but go, no, it's not. What being an artist is trying to have a lifelong relationship with creativity and narrative and storytelling and putting good ideas into the world. That's what I end that speech on.
Yeah.
Bit rich coming from me because I've got all the benefits of fame and now I'm coming back and lecturing people I'm not aiming for.
Yeah, but you did it with authenticity. You did it by absolutely telling your truth and everything. So I guess that's
probably
that's something, isn't
that's
it?
Yeah. Lucky. That's just lucky.
Yeah. Okay. You see, this is you're not willing to land on anything definite here. It's great. Like, you just keep playing around with every idea and there's always a counter and everything. Why did you leave Hollywood?
It wasn't like America or bust. We just went, we moved from England to LA partly because we knew we wanted to end up back in Australia, and we were so embedded in London that we sort of tore the Band-Aid off. Is that an Irish term? You know, we ripped the Band-Aid off.
Yeah.
We just went, okay, we're never going to be able to leave London. And so we sort of went, okay, this adventure, this Hollywood adventure, we'll go do that. I think our plan was 3 years. And in the end, we thought we'll stay for four because I was trying to get this film done. And it was a huge, huge project. In the end, the DreamWorks got bought and they just chucked 4 years of work in the trash, or
oh my God,
sitting in a hard drive somewhere in Hollywood now.
How do you cope with that?
Well, you cope with it because you understand you've been so damn lucky and privileged that to whine about the one that got away is unattractive and foolish.
You can be honest with me. 4 years, that's a sickener, isn't it?
It is. And look, I did other things in that time and it's easy to sort of exaggerate it. But yeah, if you can imagine getting a tree and hewing it and making it into matchsticks and then taking those matchsticks and building a full-size two-story house, that's what making an animated film's like. It's
okay.
You start with pixels and an idea and it's incremental and dedicated, unbelievable artists and storyboards and 3D rendering and digital lighting, and it's amazing. I really loved it. And we were well over halfway through. There's whole finished sequences of this film sitting on a hard drive. And they just went, that's not for us. And
can you appreciate
it? It really threw me.
Yeah. For how long?
Sarah, my wife, would say it changed me forever. In that,
really,
I was quite Pollyanna-ish. You said I got where I got by being authentic and telling your truth, and that's a very nice thing to say. And I was that guy. I was like, honestly, the creative industry can be really hard, but I lead with my heart and my hard work, and you know, it always works out because of that. You know, it's because I'm so positive and creative. And it's like, no, you just got lucky for a few years, and then you got unlucky. So it made me feel a bit cynical. It's a bit like, is it Voltaire's Candide who, you know, thinks it's the best of all possible worlds until the world is shoved in his face? I felt battered by it and it made me a bit cynical. But not just that, like the Broadway's treatment of both my musicals really wasn't what I'd hoped. And America taught me that it's not all rainbows and Skittles and cheese or whatever the phrase is. So that's all right. It's like part of growing up. And honestly, my career has been so glorious. And of course, with time, you contextualize all this. And I went back to Australia and helped write this show Upright, which is something I've made that is one of the things I'm most proud of in my life. And I can now contextualize the Hollywood. I would not have been able to write that screenplay or co-write it. I wouldn't have slightly battered thing that's all in my character, Lucky and Upright. It's all in it. In that whole story is about overcoming the mistakes we make and stuff. And so I fed all that sort of disappointment and slight bitterness into my next project, and that project became something I'm very proud of. So, you know, it all makes sense in hindsight, like everything in life, time is good to you.
You know that Willie Nelson song, "All the things I did, all the mistakes I made, they're all the things I have to do to get here." That's kind of it, isn't it? Or as you put it in the third speech, we all go through shite, but we can use it as fertilizer afterwards if we're lucky.
Yeah, I say in that speech, we bring everything we are into everything we do, or we should, like, not just as artists, but this idea of authenticity, again, it's a fridge magnet. You know, I talk about fridge magnetism. It's like, yeah, we've all read that on a frickin' tea towel. But this idea of authenticity, if we unpack that a bit, it's really about saying, and this is what Upright's about. It's all this metaphorical thing with he delivers this piano, which is all scratched and scarred, but still beautiful. And it's partly beautiful because of how scratched and scarred it is. And I guess authenticity, and this is a very sort of 49-year-old man sort of thing to say, but it's really about going, we're not like perfect humans dragging around our bad bits secretly behind us and pretending they don't exist. We are humans because of our scars. And I think Irish people and Brits and Scots are really good at going, oh, look, I'm a bit shite. You know, when you meet, this is a difference between Irish and English people and Americans. Americans always present with their shiny good stuff. And then over time, you'll find that they too are just human and have flaws. Like, we tend to present with our flaws, and it's why I'm more comfortable in outside of America, is because I think we know that we are made of our crappy bits.
Yeah. I mean,
and part of how we socialize is to admit that.
Yeah, you know? I can't imagine you in Hollywood. You're not enough person enough for those people. Tim,
yeah.
I was expecting a kind of a more frivolous conversation, but I think this has turned into quite a moving conversation. So, to wit, can I ask you about something? And it's on authenticity. And
yes,
I've just read about it, and it struck me as a really extraordinary thing, which was that in November you were doing a gig in Sydney, and at the Encore, you came out and told the audience that your mother, Roz, had died the day before the show, and then you sang your song, White Wine in the Sun, and you sang Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. And, like, I've read people who were there saying it was one of the most beautiful moments of their lives, one of the most beautiful things they've ever seen. It's amazing that you were able to do it and that you wanted to do that. Will you just talk to me about it for a minute before we finish up?
Yeah, I mean, those reactions are why you do it, I suppose, because I'm very lucky. I mean, I'll just say it over and over again. I'm very lucky, and I've ended up being able to play concerts where, because I sort of extracted myself from comedy, my concerts are still fun and funny and silly, but I'm not trapped anymore. I can... If my mum's died that day or the day before and I want to do a show, I know that if I tell my audience that, that'll be all right, you know, because I think what I've worked on anyway, whether I've succeeded, it's not up for me to say, but is that I come on stage with all of me. I try night after night to go, right, I'm going to be really present in the room. And because that tour that I was doing at the time, The Unfunny Evening, was all about that, was all about trying to do a concert where I'm super present in the room. When Mum died, it just didn't cross my mind that I shouldn't go to work. I said that night, I'm like, you might be thinking I'm going to say it's what Mum would have wanted. It's definitely not. She would have been like, I can't believe you went on stage. You should have been grieving, my God. But I also have this feeling that because I'm not a person with a cultural identity that I particularly attach to, you know, I'm not like, I'm a white Australian man and that's who I am. And I'm not someone with a religion, and I'm not someone who's very good at joining clubs. I'm not a person who drapes a flag over my shoulders. But I am, and it is unbelievable to me that I've been able to do this with my life. I am a performer. I'm a carny, you know, and I don't know if carny is offensive these days, but in a way, I'm circus folk, you know. Mm. And my religion has one commandment, and that is the show goes on. And that brought me great clarity, and it has brought me clarity throughout my adulthood, that whatever happens, however ill I am, whatever's going on in my life, whatever the reviewers said, you go on, and you, because there are people in the audience who have saved up or caught a train or driven 10 hours or flown. There's people who have been waiting to see me play for years, unbelievably. And there'll be someone for whom it's their first gig, and someone who's in a wheelchair who booked months ago and made sure the sign language interpreter there, whatever. There's so much that goes on, and the clarity of my one thing I do is go on stage. I did miss a show very early on in my career, but apart from that, I don't think I've ever missed a show. And when crap's happening in your life, I understand why people have religions and really strong identities, because you need a guiding light, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not attracted to any of those things, but I am attracted to the idea of the sort of guiding light purity of the show must go on. So that's what I took on stage. And yeah, the fact that people got something out of it for themselves, not for me, not like, here are my feelings about my mum, but because I'm holding up a mirror to their experiences of grief and to their relationship with their family, and maybe holding up a mirror to their dedication to their craft or whatever. I was very, very happy that it wasn't about me and my mum. It was about them and their grief, you know, and them sitting in that space with me. And yeah, at its best, that's what art can do. And I'm not claiming I succeed with everything I do, but that night was a pretty, I'll never forget that night.
Tim Minchin, thank you so much and for being so present for us today. And, you know, a lot of people doing an interview with a guy on the other side of the world, they wouldn't commit to it as fully as you committed there. So thank you very much. The book is called You Don't Have to Have a Dream. It's published by Ebury Press. Tim Minchin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brendan. It's amazing to have so much time to have a proper chat. Thanks.